Today marks 60 years since Hawaii was admitted to the State of the Union. John Rosa is an associate professor of history at the University of Hawaii and shares some insight about the forces at play during that time, August of 1959.
I'm a professional academic historian, which is what I like to say on occasion, also making fun of myself, because in terms of written histories about Hawaii, very often it had been kind of a teleological or endpoint for celebration, right? Hawaii's come a long way. It was a territory after World War II, eventually becomes a state in 59. However, like any event, historical event, there's history, which I break down for people as the events that happened, number one, but also for me, more importantly, you know, as a professional and as a person, how people look back to on historical events and interpret them and reinterpret them on the basis of their current situation, their current cultural values, and so on. So that's why statehood continues to be important.
So we mark the holiday on the third Friday of August. The actual day is not really till the 21st.
Right. The interesting issue is, for me at least, is this is 60 years since 1959. So it's only in certain years, like 25 years or 50 years or now 60 years, that you do have more discussion. So there were quite a few discussions locally as well as on the American continent in 2009 regarding how to maybe not celebrate but commemorate the events of 1959. So
give us some context then about the time and what we were going through.
For 1959 itself, it just so happens that I've been working on a book for quite some time, taking a look at the year of 1959, kind of as a historical actor, so to speak, in that a lot of people look back to 1959 in fond ways, perhaps because of statehood and the iconic photos of, let's say, somebody selling newspapers with the big headline statehood, or a young girl, you know, also smiling with statehood. And there being big celebrations, not actually in August, but in March, when the Hawaii Admission Act was passed. After March in March 1959, the news came to the then territory of Hawaii that things passed in both the House and the Senate, and President Eisenhower was going to sign the bill into law very shortly. So once the news arrived, and I think one of the stories is that it was a phone call to Governor Quinn's household, and his wife answered the phone, and it was his daughter who relayed the information. There were, you know, as you can talk to anybody who's over, I don't know what you would say, 70 or 80, celebrations in the street, people downtown going to Kauaiha Church, bells ringing, fireworks. My mother, who was about 15 years old at the time, you know, getting out of school, and at Kauaiha Church, Abraham Akaka, right, the older brother of Daniel Akaka, giving a very well-known sermon about statehood, which, you know, of course he had prepared and later published about how statehood for Native Hawaiians and local residents brings great hopes, but also great fears. And it's kind of an often quoted.
You talked about a time of great hope,
right,
a time of great fear. I think just in the times that we're living mm-hmm. in now, when what we're seeing with the movement on the mountain and
right.
Some of those feelings, I think, are wrapped up maybe in some of this and just Hawaii history in general with the overthrow.
Sure. I think taking a look at history is a practice of understanding. So, for example, why would people in the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s be pushing for statehood to begin with? And a lot of it has to do with the fact that being a territory from 1898 until 1959 was not all that great for people in Hawaii. Unlike other places like American Samoa, you did have people who, as a result of the Organic Act of 1900, automatically became U.S. citizens. But even though you might be a citizen of voting age in the territory of Hawaii, you're not able to vote for president if you want to do that. You're not able to vote for your own governor. The governor is selected by the U.S. president upon recommendation of local elites.
Usually it's a naval governor.
Right. Or somebody related to the Big Five. But also, and Hawaii has very little representation, right? You have only a delegate to Congress, a non-voting delegate to Congress, who might or might not always be effective. Prince Kuhio, for example, the second delegate to Congress, is very effective, but he does not necessarily have a vote on the House of Representatives floor. So it's kind of a way for people who grow up in the early to mid 20th century to think about being accepted, right? Especially after the events of World War II, going through martial law, so-called blood on the sands argument, Hawaii really taking a lot of sacrifices during World War II, and then finally being acknowledged for its efforts. So the perspective of the local residents is what I just discussed, but from the perspective of people on the continental U.S., and I think you're noticing I'm saying the continental U.S., you know, the mainland.
Not the mainland.
The mainland, you know, why isn't Hawaii the mainland to me, you know, to quote Joe Balas, you know, a very well-known local poet. For people on the continental U.S. in Washington, D.C., and even in the late 1800s, it's always been Hawaii's importance because of its geography, its strategic location, and assisted in the early to mid-1890s by the push by, you know, sugar planters, largely of American descent, who are able to pull off a coup and then offer Hawaii for annexation. And it takes a long time, right? It's from 1893 to 1898. But it takes a while for the United States to warm up to admitting Hawaii as a state. I think if you take a look at a serious political scientist, Roger Bell from Australia, a lot of it is party politics, the balance between Democrats and Republicans in the House and the Senate. But there's a realization that in the post-World War II Cold War era, strategic location, not just for Pearl Harbor, but for the emerging aeronautics age and age of developing ICBMs, right, intercontinental ballistic missiles, that Hawaii is going to be very, very important. Also, ideologically, it's in the Cold War era that the U.S. has to position itself as being, you know, benevolent and a forerunner in democracy and acceptance during the Cold War era, and Hawaii is a perfect place. It's a little bit later in 1960 that John F. Kennedy, when he's running for president or shortly thereafter, says, you know, Hawaii is what America wants to be, you know, a multiracial, multiethnic place. Part of it is also public relations. There are civil rights struggles in the American South that the Soviet Union and other people are always pointing to as, you know, a blot on the history and current situation of the United States then. So there are a lot of different issues. And in 1959, over the course of the year, there are a few different major things that are happening. Of course, you have, you know, statehood, and the push for statehood and the Admission Act, and also, you know, the events of August. But you also have the opening of Ala Moana Shopping Center in August, which is much anticipated, which maybe at the time was not acknowledged, but it, for me at least as a historian, it marks the move toward talking more about general American popular culture, consumer culture, and even more than Ala Moana Shopping Center, you know, being the largest shopping center in the world at the time, mm-hmm. and still, I think, the largest outdoor shopping center in the world. You do finally have commercial jet aviation. So commercial jet aviation really transforms things. You don't have people coming in, well, you still have people coming in on propeller planes, which can carry 20, 30, 50 people. But with jet aircraft, they're coming faster. It's more fuel efficient, higher capacity. So much so that by the early 60s, major air carriers are complaining to the young state of Hawaii that there are not enough hotels to accommodate all visitors. You do have people like the Kellys who are starting to build more and more outrigger hotels, but you also have people like Henry J. Kaiser, right, who, as the story goes, comes right after World War II when he's retired in his early 70s and develops this huge suburb called Hawaii Kai, right, by dredging Manalua Bay and Kuapapan, which Kuapapan is actually the largest fish pond or set of fish ponds in the entire in all of Polynesia. So there's a lot of different kinds of activities going on in 1959 itself.
Interesting threads there,
right,
when you look back at the history. And here we are today, 10 million visitors, right? And we still have the
right
issue where folks are saying not enough hotels.
Right.
Yeah. So
and also, you know, only about, 1.4, 1.5 million people. And if you look at Hawaii Tourism Authority figures, depending on where you are, what island, what time of year, the ratio between visitors to residents can be, you know, 3-1, 4-1, 5-1. Not nearly as bad as, let's say, places in the Caribbean, but certainly, you know, taxing on the infrastructure of different places.
Right,
so in Hawaii.
So you've got the natural resource, you've got the influence of the economy, the military, the political forces at work in the, well, as we say now, the Indo-Pacific. And so what's forward? What now?
I don't know. I'm probably the worst person to ask because I'm always looking backward for history. But part of it also has to do with, I'm not an economist, but, you know, the changing nature of capitalism, right? A lot of people have always understood capitalism as a way to talk about class relations and labor, and maybe in the last few decades about consumer products. But with information technology being what it is and big companies like Google and Amazon, you do have the trading of information, which is also valuable, which is really changing what's valuable and not valuable for people in different ways. The internet itself, information itself, is also changing the kinds of discussions, the kinds of conversations that people are having. With TMT, for example, I think many years ago, if you talked to people outside Hawaii, they would say, well, why wouldn't you want to explore science, right? But as we've seen over the last couple of months, you know, social media and other ways to get information out allows for more complex discussions about different value systems at play locally and also globally that might or might not necessarily be incompatible. And I think, you know, I'm also not a political scientist. In terms of politics, it's hard to predict what might happen unless people are willing to talk to each other and also try different things that they might not have tried a decade or two ago.
That was John Rosa, Associate Professor of History at the University of Hawaii. He'll be featured Saturday at a forum, The Promise of Statehood, at the Hawaii State Library in Honolulu from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. He'll be joined by Governor John Wahee, as well as the author of the book, Unsustainable Empire, Alternatives of Hawaii Statehood. Dean Saranilio is an associate professor at New York University. We'll hear more from him next week. And the forum will also include Anne Misawa. She's the director of the film, a documentary that will be screened called State of Aloha.